Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nathan Ramsey with Landiscow Regional Council, and welcome to our weekly COVID-19 call. We've been hosting these calls, I guess, since late March, early April, to try to keep our region informed and share information in response, how to better respond to the coronavirus health pandemic that our region and state and nation are facing. Just a few housekeeping matters before we get started. These calls are recorded. Everyone on the call should be muted, and the you cannot unmute yourself. So for a security precaution. So to if you would like to ask a question or have anything you would like to say, please enter that into the chat function. If you're unable to do that, you can text my number at 828-768-3216. That's 828-768-3216, or you can send me an email to nathan@landofsky.org. We really appreciate Drew Christie with the governor's office joining us. Drew's always been very helpful and faithful to join us for most of these calls. And I think the governor has a press conference today at 2 o'clock. So I've joked with Drew that he can just give us the Cliff Note version of that prior to. So if folks want to find out what's happening, they can reach out to Landiscow first, maybe. But I know that may not be possible, and we understand that. So I'll turn it over to Drew, and he can give us a brief update from the governor's office.
Thank you, Nathan. And sorry, there will be no sneak previews for the governor's press conference today. But I will go over some of the numbers that Secretary Cohen will discuss, because it's the weekly COVID-19 update. To start off on that front, let's see. Currently, there have been 4.2 million tests completed, and there have been a total of 285,661 positive cases in North Carolina, and there are currently 1,193 people hospitalized due to COVID-19, and it looks like as of yesterday, there was an increase of 9 people that were hospitalized due to COVID just from yesterday alone. So all these numbers are heading in the wrong direction. And again, Secretary Cohen will cover more of this at the press conference at 2 o'clock. And if you want to view that, please go to your local PBS station. They will be showing that at 2 o'clock. Also, you could find it at the DHHS website or through Department of Public Safety through their website as well. They will be broadcasting it because it's being held at the Emergency Operations Center, which that's where they're always held. As for some other numbers here, looking at Division of Employment Securities, the state has paid out almost $8.6 billion in unemployment claims. There have been 917,256 claimants paid. There's currently 9,967 claims pending state resolution. So those numbers are trending in the right direction there. We're getting those out as best we can. And so that's kind of all I have. The last thing I would like to emphasize, 2 points. If you have not already done so, please download the Slow COVID NC app. It's a easy contact tracing app for your smartphone, both on Android and Apple devices. This way it can help the state track the spread if there is any. Also, and we always need to remember this, remember your 3 W's: to wear a face covering, to wash your hands frequently, and to wait 6 feet apart from one another. And with that, Nathan, I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, can you tell, thank you, Drew, we appreciate that update. Can you tell us who won the presidential election in North Carolina?
You'll have to keep waiting.
We certainly want to congratulate Governor Cooper. It appears certainly a lot of votes are still outstanding. I know some absentee ballots and others, but his vote margin appears to be great enough that that result would not change. So congratulations to Governor Cooper. And again, thank you for your willingness to always share with us. So I'll turn it over to someone who may be able to tell us who will win the presidential election in North Carolina and also in the country. So Chris Wall with EQB Strategic is with us, and also Andy Munn. And I will turn it over to you guys. And thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Nathan. A little bit went on this week, huh? A lot of, and it's still going and may go for some time. So we'll just give a quick recap. How about this? I'll start with D.C. Obviously, the presidential election is unknown at this point in time. But it is the higher probability that Vice President Biden will win the necessary electoral votes than President Trump. It is a very difficult path for President Trump to get to 270. I think there were some just announcements just here in the last hour that made it even more difficult. But I think when Nevada announces, it looks like Vice President Biden has won Nevada. And when they announce, I think that will be the nail in the coffin, or I should say that will be the victory electoral votes that he needs to move on, no matter what happens with Georgia, North Carolina, or Pennsylvania, which, oh, by the way, most likely will go to President Trump. I think that if you just look at the outstanding votes that are in question versus what happened on Election Day, it's unlikely that the outcomes of the North Carolina elections will change. What is very interesting about the national vote is that it was assumed by a lot of people, including myself, if Vice President Biden won the presidency, that the Democrats would retake the United States Senate. That also, while still is not completely squared away, is unlikely to happen. And not only does it look like Biden's going to win the president, the Republicans are going to keep the Senate. The Republicans actually picked up seats in the House as well. So a scenario that honestly nobody saw, which goes to show this presidential election was all about Donald Trump, right? And you either loved him or you hated him. And it was a complete referendum on him. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic. You've got the North Carolina Senate race is yet to be called, but again, it's unlikely that that Cal Cunningham will be able to produce the votes from the outstanding ballots to overtake Senator Tillis. So Senator Tillis will, for all intents and purposes, will be named the winner here shortly. And that will, as long as the Georgia Senate seats go according to plan, which will be very high profile, and there'll be a lot of money put into that Senate, because you could have two potential runoffs. But it's highly unlikely, I think, given at this point in time, that Georgia will elect two Democrat senators. They're a fairly red state, and I think that will maintain the balance of power for the Republicans in the United States Senate. Which, for our purposes, lends the ability for Congress to do another COVID package before Christmas. And Senator McConnell actually just put out yesterday that he is in favor of moving a COVID package before Christmas or here in the next few weeks in the lame duck, and something that he is going to work for. The only issue with that is the president's, one of the president's top fiscal advisors put out a statement that said if the President Trump does lose, he probably will not look to be one of his last acts to add $2 trillion to the federal deficit. So you've got some folks at odds with each other. I remind everybody that Biden and McConnell are friends, and Biden would like to get this off of his plate as soon as possible. He would like to deal with infrastructure and COVID relief in his first 100 days, first two quarters, and then get the latest COVID relief package off his plate. It's just something that he doesn't have to worry about. So that bodes well for potential relief coming back to the states before Christmas. Again, you know, it's still McConnell's going to have to deal with it on his level, so it won't be as robust as some packages have been proposed. But I think you will see state and local funding coming, potentially state and local funding coming before Christmas. Now, North Carolina, also a very different scenario than most of us had anticipated. The Senate, which we thought could flip to the Democrats, stayed in Republican control. The Republicans have 29 seats currently. They, as long as the votes hold, they will have 28 seats going into the 2021 session. There is one seat that is still in question, and that's the Harper Peterson Michael Lee race on the coast in the Wilmington area. That race is only separated by, I can't remember, receiving 1,000 votes. I mean, it's very slim margin. Will most likely go to, it will definitely be a recount. So that may change the scenarios, but at most, you know, that's a one seat flip. The Republicans are going to keep control of the Senate. In the House, also a scenario that I don't think any of us anticipated. We thought the Democrats would definitely pick up seats. We didn't think, because of the way the districts were drawn, that they would have the ability to retake the House. But after election, the House Republicans actually picked up seats. And so they have a 65-55 majority right now. And there shouldn't be any changes to the House at this point. They're going to have a 69-61 seat advantage going into 2021. So, and obviously, you know, Roy Cooper was elected. He had the largest victory of any candidate in the state. Attorney General Stein was reelected. So as Andy likes to point out, North Carolinians went and voted for Donald Trump and Tom Tillis, and then Roy Cooper and Josh Stein, right? And that's where the purple state that we are. Council of State probably fared a little better for the Republicans than Democrats, but you had most incumbents reelected. You did have Mark Robinson, who's the first African-American to serve as lieutenant governor, was elected on the Republican side. In an open seat on the Department of Public Instruction, Catherine Truitt was running on the Republican ticket. She won that election. Wayne Goodwin, who is a Republican, was reelected insurance commissioner. Elaine Marshall, Secretary of State, who is a Democrat, was reelected.
I think you said Wayne Goodwin was reelected.
Mike Causey was reelected. But I think if you look at Council of State now, it's 6-4 Republicans. And I think what that ultimately boils down to, it's a lot of status quo going into 2021. So think of the same battles that we had this year in the General Assembly. We anticipate having the same ones. The one thing I will say is with the House picking up the seats that it did, it makes it easier for the Speaker to override a veto than it was this session. I mean, obviously it was impossible for the Speaker to override the veto this year. Wasn't able to do it. I'm not saying that he'll be able to do it coming in, but he has to get fewer Democrats to join with his side than before. So that's the recap. We should see, I imagine the election results will be made official November 13th because they can still count these provisionals up until the 12th. So I think that's when you will see, but I don't anticipate any of the current numbers changing from what they are.
Chris, you know, it appears like, and maybe you can, and maybe this is unknowable at this time, but certainly if Vice President Biden is elected to the presidency, and the numbers appear to hold it in the Senate and the House at the federal level, is that a recipe for gridlock? And also at the state level, you know, are we in for a 2.0 or 3.0 of gridlock? Because there was a lot of back and forth between the governor and the legislature, and you know, we effectively they didn't even pass a budget. I guess they were focused on passing those mini budgets, but you know, where are we? And maybe that's what the voters wanted, is a divided government.
You know, I'll tell you, in DC, I am cautiously optimistic that we are going to see more comedy in DC than we have seen since 2008. When President Obama was elected, you know, one of the very first acts, honestly, it wasn't him, it was Congress, was the stimulus bill. And that was very polarizing. Republicans felt like they were cut out of the process. You couldn't find a Republican that would support the stimulus bill. And that kind of set the stage going forward for the animosity between the Republican-controlled Senate and the presidency. Obviously, when President Trump was elected, you had the Democrats with the House and Speaker Pelosi, and I think we all know that Speaker Pelosi and President Trump did not get along at all, right? The difference this time is Biden and McConnell are friends. They served with each other for a number of years in the Senate. I mean, 20 plus years. They are, you know, for lack of a better term, institutionalist. They have worked together on a number of different issues. And I think if President Biden can keep the House in somewhat, some parameters, guide rails on the House, that Congress may actually get some things done this time, just because of the relationship between McConnell and Biden. So I'm cautiously optimistic about that, and I'd welcome Andy's thoughts on the General Assembly. I mean, at this point in time, I think we're probably in for more of the same. I think the Republicans feel emboldened from their election night, and the interest of working with the governor is probably not as good as it was if the Democrats had picked up a few seats in the House, minus what happened in the Senate. So I'm a little less optimistic on the state level than I am on the federal level.
Andy, would you like to chime in?
He says he's muted.
Okay, I thought I unmuted him, but I will make sure, let's see, I apologize. Let me find him. I apologize. Here on the, I'm sorry. From a local government standpoint, and you see, Chris, that there will be much more willingness to respond. I know you were talking about the COVID package, but even beyond that, what's your thoughts there? And Andy, I'm clicking on this button that says asking to unmute you, and it's not responding. So I will continue to try to do that.
That may be telling you something, Nathan, just so you know. I think one of the things that Congress is going to do, and that will be also be a priority of the state government, which will impact local governments, is infrastructure. And I think you're going to see a large infrastructure package coming out of Congress. I think the North Carolina General Assembly has been looking at infrastructure from a variety of different angles, including, you know, what to do about the gas tax because of the lack of funding we've seen in the Highway Trust Fund. So I think that's something that's ultimately going to have an impact that we haven't dealt with in some time. And then we'll hope to see that we can get some sort of budget passed this session.
I saw where the North Carolina Chamber came out with a proposal. I know they've put a big focus on infrastructure. We know the problems that DOT has had. Andy, I've changed the security settings, so you should be allowed to unmute yourself. So,
hello.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Great. Hey, Good to be part of this. Thanks, y'all. Sorry for the technical difficulties. just trying to catch back up here. What I think on a state level is, similar to what Chris alluded to earlier, is that it's basically more of the same. It's status quo has been maintained in North Carolina and Raleigh and the balance of power. We've got on the Council of State, there's six Republicans and four Democrats, not the least of which is obviously the governor and the attorney general. But I think with the House picking up four seats and the Senate, losing one, possibly two, I think you're going to have more of the same. But the big thing I think we need to think about is now Roy Cooper is a lame duck governor. And one of the things that the Republicans ran into over the past 2 years with trying to overcome some of the vetoes and trying to gather together the necessary votes to override vetoes were Democrats that were reluctant to vote against the governor. And Nathan, you'll remember from your time in the legislature when Speaker Tillis was there, and you think about things a little bit differently when the leader of the party or the leader of your organization or your caucus is going to be gone after the next election. So I think that's one. I think that's a key thing that factors in to future budget negotiations and tough votes that are going to be forthcoming in the next 6 to 9 months.
Chris and Andy, I know Chris has to leave here in a second, but you had mentioned a infrastructure bill at the federal level and at the state level. I know there's a lot of work. What's the focus on broadband? We got a question about that. Is there an effort to try to go beyond where they are? I know we have the GRADE Act at the state level, which has been helpful, but there's still a lot of work to be done, and especially with so much remote learning and working going on.
Yeah, I think you're going to see the League of Municipalities are going to push very hard for their bill, which would allow local governments to get in the infrastructure game, obviously the broadband game. Obviously that's very nuanced into what you could and could not do. I'm not sure that has a strong chance of passing given the makeup that remains in the House and the Senate. There was a lot of opposition to that bill, and I give the League credit. They have changed to try to address some of those concerns, but I still just think there's a natural apprehension to passing something like that in the state of North Carolina. I think what they did do is, and the governor did this just about a month or so ago, is put money for devices and hotspots, including upfitting hotspots that can be deployed throughout the state that then carriers can take advantage of. But we saw in the COVID package, they continue to increase the GRADE program. So long-winded way, Nathan, of saying it's going to be interesting to see what they do on broadband. I think right now they are invested in the GRADE Act until they see something better. And I don't know that they have anything better in front of them right now.
And I guess this depends on if there's significant action at the federal level with another CARES Act. But will the General Assembly that goes down to Raleigh in January, will they be looking at a multi-billion dollar deficit, which will impact their ability to fund, public schools, infrastructure, or other things? Or, I know we've talked about that before, but what do you think that environment will be in early 2021?
Andy, what do you think?
Sorry. I think. Can y'all hear me? Am I still on mute?
We good? No, we can hear you.
We can hear you. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think there's a real opportunity for that. North Carolina's in a pretty good fiscal situation, and I think there's lots of opportunity there.
One last question, I'll let y'all go. I know the governor, you know, this is one of the first things he mentions every time he talks or speaks, Medicaid expansion. And there was some effort on the House side to come up with something. You know, there's a Care for Carolina effort that's trying to sort of thread the needle there for healthcare expansion. I know the Senate was just seemed like it was dead on arrival at the state Senate side. And certainly there was resistance at the House level too, but it seemed like, you know, there was some leadership there. I know Josh Dobson has moved on, but some are still there. Do you think they'll be able to find a compromise to that, or is it just going to be another, they'll be at loggerheads over that?
Yeah, I can jump in on that one. I think long-term, that's going to be a position that the Republicans are going to have to relent on and adopt the Care for Carolina model or something like that. I don't think it's objecting to Medicaid expansion outright is not something that is a sustainable position for them. So I'm not sure I would wager that it would not happen this year, but if the Republicans remain in control for say the next 6 years to 4 years, there's going to have to be some sort of compromise that's going to need to be reached there, because I do believe it's reaching a point where folks are recognizing that, you know, there's some folks out there that don't have the necessary access to healthcare that they need to have, even though they're you know, working and they just simply can't afford it. So I'm not optimistic. Long story short, I'm not optimistic this year, but I think in the coming probably 2-3 years, there will be some sort of movement on that toward expansion.
Chris, Andy, any final thoughts? I'll let you go. I mean, this has been very helpful, and we really appreciate you taking time. I know y'all have been probably very busy since the election.
No, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for sharing with us, and maybe we can have you back later as we learn more. So y'all have a wonderful day. We're fortunate to have with us Daryl Kane with the Keenan Fellows, a fellowship at NC State. And I'll let Daryl explain the Keenan Fellowship to you. But Daryl, I'll make sure I can unmute you. So Daryl, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon, Nathan. Thanks so much for having me on the call. And hello, everyone. Hope you're having a great day.
Well, thank you for joining us. And the Keenan Fellowship is a great opportunity to connect the workplace and our K-12 educators, and to help students become more aligned with the work opportunities that are available and the career opportunities that are available in their communities. And also it's a great opportunity for educators to understand those what local businesses need, what local employers need. So Daryl, I'm gonna try to share your presentation, and okay. And we'll just start from there. So thank you for joining us again.
Yeah, thank you. So again, Daryl Kane, work with the Keenan Fellows Program. We're based at NC State University, go Pack. And we're also an initiative out of the Keenan, it's one of the Keenan Institutes, which is based at NC State as well. Also on the call today is Tom White, who's one of our board advisors. He's at NC State Economic Development, so he may have some kudos to share as well as we kind of talk through this. So you can go to the next slide, Nathan. So our program has been around about 20 years, and really one of the most successful STEM programs that I've seen. I've been around this for quite a while. And we're a small staff. We have 5 staff members, and we're all professionals, and just really trying to make a difference in K-12 education across the state. So Our philosophy is that if we really empower a teacher in a community and make the connections with business partners, that really affects students and gives the students ideas of what's possible in, within that industry and within that community as far as career awareness. And it also helps the teacher to grow in his or her leadership ability as far as impacting peers, really leading in the classroom, and obviously for promotion opportunities into school leadership or district leadership. So we have about 500 teachers that have been through the program over the past 20 years. And, you know, a lot of those, the goal is for most of them to stay in the classroom, but obviously some of them have been promoted and moved up into administration. So you can go to the next slide. So we're, as I mentioned, we are an initiative of the Keenan Institute, and we get about 10% of our funding from the state and from NC State. And then the rest is basically through fundraising, which is where I focus at. Just a little bit of background on me is I've been with Keenan Fellows for about a year. Previously, I've been with the Department of Commerce and Division of Workforce Solutions. So that's how I know Nathan and Tom White and several other workforce development leaders across the state. So that's kind of my background, West Point graduate, and spent 5 years as an Army officer after West Point. But so really the, how the program is set up is that we basically give the teacher some great professional development while they stay in the classroom. And so most of this is, we have a week-long summer professional development conference, then we have a fall and spring event, and that adds up to about 80 hours worth of professional development. We also have a program manager who does one-on-one coaching with all of our alum cohort as well. So typically we have anywhere from 18 to 30 teachers per year that go through the program. And so we're looking at around that 30 year for next year. So in addition to the 80 hours of professional development, a teacher spends a 3-week summer internship at a business partner or higher education partner site. And the goal is really to learn what industry does and be able to take that back to the classroom in some form or fashion. A lot of times teachers are creating new project-based learning units that are really industry focused and really gives the students something to look forward to and something that relates to the curriculum and also relates to a career that they could eventually have. And this is a K through 12, so we have high school, middle school, and elementary school teachers that go through the program. It is a competitive process, so typically we open up applications in December for teachers to apply for different opportunities, and a teacher applies for opportunities within their region. So I'll talk a little more about that in a couple of slides. The nice thing is that once that relationship is built between the teacher and the business, it's an ongoing relationship. So it's a way to get speakers into the classroom. It's a way to get students out to business partner sites and university sites. And it's just a great network that we have across the state. In addition, the teacher receives a $5,000 stipend to go through the program, which kind of helps to offset some of the costs for, you know, for their time. So this is a picture of our this year's cohort. So there's 17 or 18 here on this slide, and you can see it's a pretty diverse group. And we have people, I didn't put a map on here, but we have some of these, three or four of these in Western North Carolina, a lot in the Triangle, some in Charlotte, and some out in Eastern North Carolina. So it's spread pretty widely across the state. So here's just a snapshot of the partners that we're working with for this current year. And basically a partner is usually a business or a higher education partner. They're providing some grant funding, and then we'll basically connect the fellow to their organization. So some organizations do too, like Biogen and Facebook. You know, obviously they can afford that. And then, you know, we have some others that do, you know, one per year. So Cornerstone Building Brands is one of our great partners. Tom White was really influential in kind of getting them started. I don't know if Tom has anything he wants to share, but feel free to jump in and share if you'd like, Tom, anytime. So looking ahead to 2021, we've got a couple of different initiatives. You can go back a slide, actually. So basically, we have a couple of different initiatives that we're looking at for next year. We're obviously running our fellowship program. It's a little bit different with COVID. So typically, we do a lot of in-person professional development, but this year, we've turned it more into online and virtual. So we'll probably continue that for next year as well. I'll also mention that, so we do have opportunities for business partners if you want to host a fellow. It's usually a $15,000 to $20,000 donation that we receive for each fellow. So that's available for any of the business partners on the call. And then we also want to mention one of our new programs called STEMWork, which is a more of a blended learning model. You can move forward maybe one slide there, Nathan. which is a blended learning model, which is new that we're going to start in June of 2021. So we're going to have six teams out in Western North Carolina. So the difference here is that it's not as much face-to-face. It's more online professional development. And then it doesn't have the long internship, but it has like a one-day visit to an industry partner site. So if a company would be interested in bringing, you know, basically sponsoring a team, that'd be like a $5,000 investment. Or if you just wanted to just get involved in some form or fashion, it could be down to $500. So we're basically kind of trying to work with people where they are. Really excited about this new program. It's basically going to be, you know, it's going to be, a lot more available to more teachers. So a team is basically one facilitator and five teacher participants. And this could be, basically K through 12 teacher as well. So we're going to definitely kind of grow our impact in large numbers through this program. So we have, I believe, six teams in a triangle and 11 teams in a triangle, six out in Western North Carolina. The other thing I'll mention too is that, say if a company wants to host a fellowship but doesn't have the financial means to do it, we do have a partnership with Facebook. So Facebook sponsors two fellows every year, but just due to their IT security, they can't have, lots of visitors within their the facility out in Western North Carolina. So for companies interested in basically just hosting a fellow, that's an opportunity. Last year, Biltmore Farms and Eaton Corporation hosted two fellows through a Facebook donation. So that might be an opportunity.
And Daryl, how many companies are you looking to host a fellowship in our region? Is that the one that's limited to Henderson County in our region?
So those will be two. So if you don't have the grant funding that you can provide, you could do, and we have two options open. And then if a company does want to do something, it's basically we could do five or six different companies that we could add to your region if there's funding available.
I know we have some employers on the call, and so if they would like to learn more, I will certainly share your contact information, and I think you have that at the end of your slide, but you can share that in the chat as well. And I've unmuted Tom, if Tom has anything to add.
Nathan, thank you so much. And I wanted to thank you for facilitating this wonderful partnership that is emblematic of something that we refer to as the triple helix of academia, business, and government working in concert. A couple of years ago, our Keenan Fellows Executive Director, Elaine Franklin, accompanied a cohort of NC State staff members from Keenan Fellows and hosted by Nathan and Jack Cecil at Biltmore Farms. And that was somewhat consistent with and analogous to the Backpacks to Briefcases program, which Daryl and I worked on about 4 or 5 years ago. That's won national awards that Nathan piloted in the Mountain Area Workforce Development Board region to great success. I see Barbara Darby on the call. But I have to also congratulate you on wonderful Pratt & Whitney announcement with 800 jobs and $650 million of capital investment. Those are the sorts of economic development announcements that bode so well for the entire region. And we believe that at the Keenan Institute that it's all about human capital investment, that's what draws that kind of significant capital investment. And so I just wanted to reiterate our sincere thanks to Nathan and the Land of Sky and Mountain Area for being such wonderful partners to us here at NC State.
Thank you so much, Tom. We appreciate the partnership we have with NC State and with the Keenan Fellowship and through the Keenan Institute and also through the university at large. You have a great presence in our region, and we appreciate you, not forgetting about Western North Carolina. I don't know if here's the slide with Daryl's contact information, and he will add that in the chat. Are there anyone that would have any questions for Daryl or how your company could get started? One of the challenges has been, there is a funding component. So in the past, I think you received an ARC grant to help defray some of that cost for some companies. This is wonderful for the Facebook opportunity. So for companies in Henderson County that may have an interest, and for also coming up with an alternative where it's not as expensive, but an employer can host a fellowship for around $5,000. I know there's nothing more impactful than to have an educator embedded in your business and where they can see what you do. And then they're able to share that with their colleagues at their school and with their students. So it's very powerful. But is there anything else y'all would like to add?
I really appreciate the time today. We're glad to have a conversation with anyone to kind of talk about how we can maybe partner. We've got those are sort of our main two initiatives. We've got some other things that we probably won't go into today, but we're trying to really expand those partnerships between industry and K-12 education. So we're really excited about the work that's happening. And actually, Western North Carolina is a great example across the state of just making those kind of partnerships. So you guys are already doing a great job with that.
I don't think I see any other questions through the chat, but please reach out to Daryl or myself and I'll get you in touch with Daryl and the Keenan Institute. We appreciate Daryl and Tom White from NC State joining us today. And we hope to build more partnerships between our educational institutions and employers in our region. And this is just one of many efforts. And we're so grateful for y'all's support of Western North Carolina. But if anyone doesn't have anything else to add, we'll give you back the rest of your day. Just want to remind you, we'll try to put recordings of these calls on the Land of Sky website. I think we're a little behind in doing that, but we'll try to get that updated. You can go to landofsky.org. Appreciate all the work that you do for our region. If you have any questions of me or ways that Land of Sky Regional Council can assist you, certainly reach out to me or some of our team here at Land of Sky, and you can find all of our staff member contact on our Land of Sky website. So thank you all so much for being with us. We again thank Drew Christie with the Governor's Office, Chris Wall and Andy Munn with EQB Strategic, and also Daryl Kane and Tom White with the Keenan Institute for sharing with us today. So y'all have a great day. Stay safe, stay well, and enjoy this beautiful November day.